Our last speaker of the morning, or afternoon, is Dr. Joel Berger. He's a field scientist with the Wildlife Conservation Society. He's worked with us since 1990. Most recently, over the last few years, he's been a very important part of our North America programs. He did his graduate work at University of Colorado. He spent 7 years as a Smithsonian Research Fellow and 16 years as a professor at the University of Nevada. He studied numerous species, including rhinos, caribou, Kulan, grizzly bear, wolves, bison, moose, and maybe he'll let us know about a few more. Dr. Berger.
Thanks. The lights turned down about 15% of their volume. Also, I'd like to thank Billy Karasch and Steve Osofsky and Bob Cook for inviting me. And I want to point out on the program it says I'm a DVM, but I'm not. Okay. What I'm going to do today is focus on four issues. The first two will be the first concerns that conservation means different things to different people. Secondly, I'll follow up on some of the talks that we've had with respect to CWD and talk about densities of wild populations and what those implications are. Then I'm also going to talk about the unintended effects of goodwill and what some of the consequences of that goodwill has meant. And then finally, I'll talk about the thing that Bob had asked me to talk about, and those were the conservation implications, and I will deal with species and then with ecosystems. So we've already heard that the major species that have CWD in the wild are mule deer, elk, white-tailed deer, and not moose, although in captivity, a couple of cases have been induced. I'm just going to streamline these because we've heard these things before. We know where CWD is. It's in about 14% of the states in the wild. If we add in captivity, it goes up to about a quarter of the states. And it's also in Alberta and Saskatchewan. What is conservation? Well, a lot of us think that conservation means animals, but it can also mean plants. It can obviously mean ecosystems and people. And for my talk today, I'm going to wrap all of this, but my talk will focus on animals, and I'll mention a little bit about plants in a couple of minutes. So for today, conservation, the important point here is that humans are part of this equation. We know that there are ecological consequences of CWD. We haven't talked much about those. I will touch on those with respect to animal populations. We also know that humans can be infected. I've seen different values for how important sport hunting is in terms of human economies. $10 million is what I've heard Leslie talk about. Beth Williams in Wyoming, where it plays a larger proportion, would claim it's $20 billion, and Leslie had said 10. Clearly, it plays some fairly important economic role, also a cultural role. And then there's an interaction between animals and humans, and I will follow up on that. Distribution-wise, we know that there are hot spots. If we look at some of the data that the Colorado Division of Wildlife has put out looking at actual densities, what we find is, and just to frame this for you, Denver would be here's Denver. And so the darker or the hotter the red, the higher the densities. And some of the programs that have been involved have tried to first understand what densities are in the wild, meaning not in captivity or on fenced-in areas where we have ranched animals. And so animals have been radio-collared. They've been put in numerous areas along the Rocky Mountain front. Also, hunters have played an important role in terms of monitoring because they bring in animal products for screening and prevalence testing. Overall, in these areas, what we find is a display of what the different values are. We can find a hot spot here, 18%. And if we look across what we have, and this was touched on also, if we look at the prevalence in males and females, we find that there's a differential prevalence. Generally, males have a higher prevalence rates. This high value for white-tailed deer, note that it's just based on a tiny, tiny sample, one out of actual seven animals, and so we should not think too much about that. What's the relationship among ecology and density and prevalence? Well, little is known about factors that remove infected animals from the wild other than hunting or hunters. But it would be nice to know. The supposition may be because if these animals become lethargic, predators may be involved in removal of some animals. Note here, and we're not sure why this deer is not responding. We didn't get a good picture of it, but there is a predator there. Question is really, can people be somewhat ecologically redundant? And the crash here of this Humvee is not because there was a problem. Well, there was obviously a problem. The question at hand is whether or not cars have a differential impact in removing infected animals. And so if we look at here in our control, and these are work based on Colorado Division of Wildlife, within a 3-kilometer area, we've developed, somewhat of a regular prevalence rating. If we look at the animals that are removed by vehicles, when vehicles crash and kill deer, these are mule deer, it's about 3 times as frequent. So there may be something going on in terms of these animals not being able to avoid either stalking cougars, but clearly the data are bearing out with respect to fast-moving or slow-moving cars, as the case may be. What about density? We've talked about density a little bit, and the assumption is regularly made that in captivity, we have a high prevalence rate. But what we don't know is that much about the association between captive settings and field densities. In other words, that relationship is not as clear. So what I've shown here for 17 different study areas, which include most of the western states, but I've also thrown in some examples from UK and Scotland, we find that the average winter densities are about 13 elk, or in Europe, red deer, per square kilometer. But there's a high range of variation, and the dotted lines at the top and the bottom are showing your 95th percent confidence intervals. But on average, about 13. All right, we're going to ratchet down the scale here. And so notice we've just changed the scale. We've got the same graph, but we've got the scale has changed. These are what the densities are in captivity. Clearly, numerous orders of magnitude larger. So, with high densities, high potential for problems under these captive settings, our concerns should be exacerbated if we export this to the field. Well, here one of the areas that a lot of people are concerned about, the Greater Yellowstone ecosystem. I mean, amongst other things, Yellowstone was the first national park in the world. The first national forest was Shoshone-Nxiwit, and Wyoming would want me to say that it was the first state where females could vote. All right. For Yellowstone, what we have is a very large ecosystem, some 200,000 ungulates, but it's also been the site of a lot of other activity and action. Wolves have been restored to Yellowstone, so we have one threatened or endangered species there. Also, grizzly bears are there. This ecosystem draws in millions of people each year, and so it's important as a place where people go and play. I'm going to segue into how we get into some of these issues with densities and goodwill. Turn of the century, ranching came to an area called Jackson Hole, Wyoming, the southern part of Yellowstone Park. Elk were starving, and people wanted to do something good for elk because their winter habitat had been squeezed out by humans. And so as a humane action, artificial feeding was introduced, and the National Elk Refuge was formed. The point here, humans have done something good. What are some of the consequences? Well, what we know is that the elk population has increased dramatically. There are about 100,000 elk in that system today. But what we have is a reversal because elk are now good for humans. Humans did something good for elk. What's changed over the last 85 years since the National Elk Refuge was formed? Well, we now have bison in that system. In fact, to the point that bison have invaded a feed ground in that area. And there are also 22 feed grounds where the state of Wyoming provides food for the benefit of elk to make it through the winters. So what we've done is come full circle from wild with no feeding, semi-wild with winter feeding, some situations where it's exclusive feeding, and then in captivity. And so thinking about what this means, this may be globalization, North American style, as we heard from Trent, that we've gone from captive, some animals have at least been claimed to have escaped, some are semi-wild, some are wild, problems have been exported across different lines, both state and an international border. So again, we've got a human economy that is somewhat dependent on animals. Animals have been dependent on humans as well. So what are the conservation implications? Well, if we just think about systems, the boundaries of a single species define the Serengeti. These would be wildebeest. We can claim that perhaps not the boundaries of Yellowstone, but clearly the dynamics of Yellowstone are shaped and defined by one species, that species being elk. And so let's build a food web. We know that wolves are dependent on elk. About 90 to 95% of the diet of wolves in the system are comprised of elk. Grizzly bears take more elk calves than any other species. In fact, grizzly bears, through their predation on elk calves, have an effect on elk population dynamics. Cougars have a highly interactive and somewhat of a dependent relationship with elk. Black bears, in areas where grizzly bears do not occur, are the single largest predator on elk calves. And so, we don't always think of bears as carnivores, but they can clearly be effective carnivores, and we know that there's some relationship between elk and carnivores. If we think about the next layer down and think about animals that feed on vegetation, we know that white-tailed jackrabbits and black-tailed jackrabbits have some relationship because the food that they feed on is also highly overlapping with elk at different times of the year. And then we can look at some of the other ungulates that live in that system. In the winter time, elk and moose somewhat compete in riparian zones. It's unclear what's going on, if anything, between elk and bison, other than that they both share brucellosis. If we think about food web dynamics, we know that herbivore populations will change if elk populations change. Other tiers. This one I've labeled bait. Red foxes are scavengers. They enjoy elk calves. Coyotes as well. And then, as we've heard, aerial scavengers are important. Ravens, because they will be affected by elk abundance, as will bald eagles, and golden eagles also. So scavengers are highly supported by this cervid biomass. Another tier, vegetation. We know that elk modify the vegetation because their densities are quite high. And this has been verified in a variety of studies, and I'm just streamlining those studies here. Also, riparian areas, these water vegetation along streams where there are willows and cottonwood and aspen. And as a consequence of changes in riparian vegetation communities, neotropical migrants have been altered as well. And so another tier involves elk, vegetation, and avian biodiversity. So let's try to streamline and move through this. If we think about big herbivores, we know that carnivores are dependent upon them, as are small mammals, as are other ungulates. I didn't do that. Oh, there were three blanks? Really? Keep going. No, last night everything was on. All right. The food web dynamic that I was just showing you would have concluded by showing that if we change the densities of elk, we can expect decrement in wolves and grizzly bears, both which are threatened and endangered species and governed by a lot of different legislation. So we could also expect decreases in coyotes as well as bald eagles. But how likely are these scenarios? Okay, Recall what I showed normal densities are in the wild, what we have for captive densities. What do we have on feed grounds? Here the changing densities, and note here that the scale changes as well. And so we're looking at feed ground densities that are significantly higher than what we've had in our captive herds, where we've had very major concerns about CWD and the animals have had to be depopulated. So how do we integrate CWD and density and we'll say wolves? Well, if disease is transmitted at captive rates, then what we're going to find is that elk are going to crash. And we can add wolves on that because there's a high correlation between the density of wolves and the densities of elk. So what we'll find, species are going to decline, ecosystems are going to change, and human economies are going to be impacted if we see a shift from captive, the prevalence rates in captivity, if they get into these areas of the greater Yellowstone. So let me sum up where I'm at so far, and then I want to make one final point. I've said that conservation means different things to different people, that there have been a fair amount of attention, and it continues, rightfully so, with looking at density regulation and impacts and transmission, that we're looking at a full circle here because there have been unintended consequences to an ecosystem by our goodwill. And then there are likely to be consequences for species and for ecosystems. Overall, what we see are fairly low average rates of CWD, even in what's been called the hot zones. The impact of CWD in terms of regulating populations, the modeling that's been done, is suggestive that those impacts are actually smaller than coyote predation or the effects of drought. And so, should we be concerned? Well, if in fact the movement of CWD continues at the rate and in the directions that it's been going, we might see rates in captivity that would be, in the greater Yellowstone that would be like this. And so, to conclude, I think we see things come full circle and a lot of interdependency, irrespective of which direction we look. Thank you.